This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hi, I'm Nicole Brussell. I'm a journalist at The Age. Thank you so much for coming to our discussion tonight on the invisible crime. Before we start, I'd like to acknowledge that we are meeting today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation and pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and pay my respects to the elders of any other communities who may be with us today. I'd also just like to give a warning that we will be discussing sexual assault, as you all are aware, and some people may find this discussion confronting. If you need support, you can contact Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence Helpline 1-800-RESPECT after the discussion. If you also feel like you need to leave during the discussion, you can approach an usher and they can take you to a quiet space. There'll also be pamphlets at the back with sexual assault services and helplines available as well, if anyone feels like they need to access those services. So last year, myself, my colleague Rachel Dexter and Eleanor Marsh embarked on quite a complex journey to chart the journey of sexual assault survivors through the criminal justice systems in Australia, which is very complex. It took a lot of time. We did over 20 Freedom of Information requests. We also accessed open source data. We spoke to over 40 survivors of sexual assault. And we found through our research, if anyone hasn't seen that series, it's available at The Age. If you just Google The Age and Invisible Crime, all of our content's there. But we found that essentially our criminal justice system, we believe, is failing victims of sexual violence, sexual assault. There are many reasons for this. But one is the private nature of sexual assault crime. It's often there are no witnesses, there's very little evidence, which can make a sexual assault case very difficult to prove in court. Look, it's important to note that every state and territory has a different legal system regarding sexual assault and any criminal matter. So a matter of commonality is that it is very difficult among adult offenders to get a conviction if you take into account the amount of reports to police that there are. So to delve into the complexities of this, I have with me Katrina Marson. Katrina, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Certainly. So my experience professionally predominantly is in criminal practice, primarily with the ACT Director of Public Prosecutions, including in the Family Violence and Sexual Offences Units. I have also spent some time on the other side of the bar table at Legal Aid ACT. I tutor in evidence law and criminal law at the Australian National University, and I also have some experience in the community sector, having sat on the Governance Committee of the Canberra Rape Crisis Centre. For the last 2 years, I have been involved in legal policy. So I've been involved in leading the ACT's response to the criminal justice recommendations made by the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. So I do have some experience in implementing law reform and how that plays out from a policy perspective. I think the other reason, or the other sort of relevant bit of information about my experience for tonight's purposes, is that I have a research interest in sex education or relationships in sex education as sexual violence prevention. So last year I conducted a Churchill Fellowship on the implementation of relationships in sex education, and I went to Europe and North America and looked at a number of jurisdictions there where they had successfully implemented that kind of education model and attempted to bring the lessons that I learnt home to Australia with me.
Thank you. And Rina Ouyang, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Nicole. So I'm wearing two different sort of hats today. I am, on one hand, I'm the co-founder of a not-for-profit called Empowered Together. That's a youth-led organisation. We run consent workshops with secondary students primarily, teaching them about consent and sexting and sexual violence prevention. On the other hand, I'm also a lawyer at Moores, where we do a lot of work with organisations such as schools, universities, and domestic violence organisations, looking at the role that they can play in preventing child abuse and sexual violence within their organisation, and also helping organisations respond to incidents that might happen in a way that's supportive towards the survivor.
Thank you. And Greg Barnes.
Sure. I'm Greg Barnes. I'm a barrister. I practice in Victoria and in Tasmania. I'm also heavily involved in the Australian Lawyers Alliance, which is a group of lawyers around Australia that are in the criminal law space and a number of other sort of human rights spaces. I've done a fair bit of writing about the issue of criminal justice and sexual assaults, sometimes taking what these days is a unfashionable view on some issues, on others really saying we need to do better and we need to look at ways of according justice to both sides. So I do some work at RMIT University in the JD program and working with Rob Holles in the Centre for Innovative Justice, where we've been looking at restorative justice.
Great. Thank you so much. Please make them feel welcome. So through our research, we found between 2016 and 17, there were between 180,000 to 290,000 people who experienced sexual violence. It's from the ABS survey. Of those, only 25,800 reported to police, and that's a huge discrepancy. We know there's many reasons people choose not to report to police. Rena, do you think that the current legal system contributes to dissuading people from reporting to police or accessing the criminal justice system?
I think it does. If you look at the what a survivor has to go through to report, first it's about making the decision. And when a survivor discloses to someone, we know that the person that they're most likely to disclose to is a close friend or a family member. And we know that how that person responds in the first instance has a huge impact on the journey that they're going to have. So a lot of survivors that I've spoken to where they've had a negative comment from someone or an inkling that the person doesn't believe them, that really sort of shuts down any further disclosures for a very long time. If we look at child abuse in particular, we know that the average time of disclosure is 23 years. So we're facing also significant barriers in terms of that time and the lack of evidence that's passed. I think as well, there is improvements with in terms of how police are handling these matters, but at that stage as well, there's a lot of barriers in terms of speaking to a police officer. Often survivors will request to speak with a female if they are female, and that can be difficult in itself. And then going through that process, and I think the mental barrier as well, thinking about trying to picture yourself sitting in a courtroom facing a defense attorney who's going to cross-examine you and potentially ask you questions like, what were you wearing, were you drunk? I think all of that puts a heavy mental barrier aside from just, you know, making the report in itself. Those initial steps of having to work through in a person's mind are really significant.
Greg, what do you think?
I think there's some truth in what's been said. I think there are no doubt there are some barriers. I think one always has to be careful looking at statistical analysis, and I do see figures bandied around about the low conviction rates. By the time a case gets to court, of course, it's gone through a number of processes. Firstly, it's looked at by police. Secondly, it's then looked at by the DPP, and then it gets to court. My own sense, and in fact fortified by some conversations recently, is that there's been a major increase in conviction rates in Victoria in the county court. I spoke to a colleague the other day about this. And so I don't disagree, but I think it's symptomatic of a system which is well and truly broken. That is the adversarial system and the way we pretend to do justice to both the defendant and the complainant or the victim in cases. And so I think that, you know, the sort of complaints you were making, I think are entirely legitimate, but it is symptomatic of a much bigger problem.
We spoke to defence barristers during our investigation who said if there was very little evidence that they could bring to court, they would not recommend their daughters go through the criminal justice system if their daughters were raped. Is that surprising, Greg?
Well, I don't think anyone wants to go into the witness box. And I think that to have to relive these matters is very painful. I'd say it about anyone, though, any victim. I think going into the witness box, I mean, when you think about it, it's a sort of 18th, 19th century practice. I don't think it's confined to sexual assaults. But I certainly think that... And the problem, though, Nicole, is this. The stakes are so high, you see. If you're acting for a defendant, there have been massive increases in sentences for sexual assaults. And so it's a winner-takes-all approach. And it means, of course, you have an obligation as counsel for a defendant to go in as hard as you can, subject to, and there are, I should say, a number of rules of evidence and procedure about what you can and can't say in relation to sexual assault and cross-examination. But it is a system where the stakes are so high for defendants that I think what we are seeing is more cases going to court that should resolve. If we weren't so obsessed with locking people up for longer periods of time and mandatory sentencing, you'd see more cases resolve. But you don't see cases resolve, and you see victims put through a case when it's clearly a weak case for the defendant, because they'll take that punt. And I think, again, that's symptomatic of a broader problem within the system.
Is it fair, though, to say if we reduce sentences for rape or sexual assault that more people will plead guilty? What do you think, Katrina?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to that, I suppose, by saying that I don't think it's just a matter of the weight of sentences that are being handed down. I think the stakes have always been high, and I think it is also to do with the stigma associated with a rape conviction, but also the knowledge that it can be very difficult for the prosecution to prove beyond reasonable doubt that a sexual assault has occurred. And so in terms of advising a client, I certainly think that there is the fact that it will be difficult for the prosecution to prove it weighs very heavily into that advice that's given. So I don't know that it's just the sentences or a potential increase that we're seeing in sentences, whether or not we are. I'm not sure that I've observed that in the ACT context. So I don't know that that's necessarily the reason for a lack of resolution of these kinds of matters. I do agree, however, that there are legitimate questions around whether the current system is appropriate for all people in dealing with sexual violence. And I think, Greg, you alluded to this, whether the adversarial system in particular is appropriate for this particular kind of offending or more generally. And I think we do need to have that conversation.
Definitely. Obviously, especially in an adversarial system, everyone wants a fair trial and everyone deserves a fair trial. Mm. At the moment, as it is, as it stands, is it a fair trial for both a survivor or a complainant and an accused? Do you think that they both get a fair go?
I think that... Working where I am at the moment, I find the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse, their findings very instructive. The Commissioner certainly made some findings about whether the fact that the current criminal justice system does have unfair impacts for victims of child... They were looking specifically at child sexual abuse, although at times they do make comments about whether that has broader implications for sexual offences generally. So I think that there is some commentary out there around whether it is in fact unfair to victims... In a way, I think it's important to recognise that, yes, everyone is entitled to a fair trial. And indeed, in the Invisible Crime documentary, I noted that one of the survivors talked about how much she respects the presumption of innocence, for example, which is a very fundamental tenet of our system of a fair trial. And I think it's really important to recognise that... As far as I'm aware, calls for reform are not often calling for some kind of reversal of the presumption or a reversal of the onus of proof, for example, but instead a way of, within the fundamental tenets of our criminal justice system that do afford fairness to the accused in the way that they must to protect the accused's human rights, how else can we perhaps balance the fairness for the victim as well, in a way that improves their access to justice, and it really is about access to justice, and their experience of the criminal justice system as well. It's not just about convictions and results. It is also very much about their experience, and certainly the Royal Commission focused on that quite heavily.
Rena, what's your view on this?
It's an interesting one. I think in the context of child abuse and the Royal Commission, you were talking about Katrina, there were a lot of legislative barriers that I think are slowly being removed. So, for example, statute of limitation would be one. I spoke previously about how for a child abuse survivor, it usually takes 23 years to disclose. And in the past, they would have been barred legally from bringing a claim because it had just been too long. And so that's been changed now in states. So we are seeing legislative reform in that aspect. I think as well, though, the law only goes so far, and being lawyers, I don't know, that's probably, you know, not something that we should be saying, but it really does. And if we look at a criminal trial for sexual assault, for example, often there are cases where there is, you know, good evidence, there's DNA evidence, there's witness testimony, and there's still an acquittal, and that's often because of whether it's jury views and misconceptions around what consent looks like and what sexual assault is. I think there's still a myth about rape and sexual assault being the stranger that pops up in the alley, and those misconceptions play a real role in terms of preventing a fair hearing and proper, I guess, administration of justice as well.
Can I just respond and say I think it is really good that as lawyers we recognise the limitations of the legal system. So I think it is good that you point that out. I've said before that the criminal justice system in particular is more arbiter than educator. And I think in recognition of, I think it's really important that we recognise that if we are to actually progress towards reducing the incidence of sexual violence in particular. But you've alluded to it in terms of the way that rape myths potentially, we know statistically the way that they impact on jury bias. And so in terms of actually recognising the limits of the law as a reactive mechanism is really important to the conversation in terms of moving forward.
Greg, do you think that currently the system is fair to survivors, adult survivors in particular?
Well, I'll just pick up some of the things that have been said about the Royal Commission. I think the Royal Commission was a very dangerous Royal Commission. In this sense, those who ran it said, how can we increase conviction rates? And that should never be your question. Your question should always be, how can we ensure trials are fair? So they started from a very dangerous premise. Last week, we saw with very little opposition, I mean, I made some comments in the media and the Law Institute did here in Victoria, but I didn't notice many others. There, because of the Royal Commission, there will now be, before a jury, your prior criminal history. Now, if this is not a recipe for dangerous reasoning on the part of jurors and gross unfairness to an accused person, I don't know what is. That comes out of the Royal Commission. There have been reversals of the onus of proof proposed by the Royal Commission. We've got to be very careful that we don't push criminal trials in sexual assaults to a space that makes it markedly disadvantageous to an accused person. And frankly, and I know this is an unfashionable view, but frankly, allowing people to know that people have got prior criminal convictions for offences in sexual abuse cases, I think is outrageous. But guess what? It'll sail through every parliament in Australia. Because the commitment to the rule of law in this country has been diminished so markedly, as we know, in the last 20 years, whether it's anti-terror laws or laws in this area. And this is not an anti-victim statement. It's saying that you've got to be careful that you don't create a system in which you get wrongful convictions, because wrongful convictions are a cancer. They are a cancer in any democracy. And there is, I'm telling you now, there is a grossly increased risk as a result of the Royal Commission's recommendations in some areas.
I do have to just jump in and respond to a couple of things there. I agree that wrongful convictions is something that we should all be extremely anxious to avoid. A couple of things I would say. The Royal Commission did not start from a position of wanting to increase convictions. They wanted to... They wanted to decrease what they saw as unfair or unjustified acquittals, and that was on the basis of quite a lot of research that they had undertaken, quite comprehensive research. So that's one thing. In terms of the recent model bill that's been proposed to reform tendency and coincidence laws or admissibility laws, it's not that they will allow for criminal histories to be admitted, it's that they will change the circumstances in which tendency and coincidence evidence is admitted, whether that includes relevant evidence that amounted to a conviction in any given case is one thing. It's not that they are going to now allow criminal histories to be admitted in evidence. It's if there is tendency evidence that meets the threshold and they happen to include a conviction, that may be admitted. And this is a situation, this kind of evidence has always been admitted in certain circumstances. What the model bill that is being implemented by the Uniform Evidence Jurisdictions does is clarify the circumstances in child sexual abuse matters only when those things will be admissible. I know so much detail about it is because I was directly involved in that work.
Just so people are clear, it lowers the test, it lowers the threshold, it makes prosecutors' jobs much easier. It's unfair. Justice McClellan, who headed that commission, made a point to a group of criminal lawyers. It's well known. How can we increase conviction rates? I find that problematic.
I'm just going to move on to another point. We spoke previously about an alternate to the adversarial system. Does everyone know what restorative justice is in this room? Show of hands. Oh, actually quite a few. I might just get you to explain restorative
justice.
I'll do it
briefly.
So
restorative justice works on the basis that you have the parties in an relatively unmediated setting meet. It's usually, in fact, it's always at the instigation and with the consent of the victim. The victim gets a chance to tell the accused how this offence has affected them. The accused gets to apologise. It has been it's preferred by victims and preferred by defendants because it has that lack of formality, but also is much more powerful. Just a very quick illustration. There's a case here in Victoria of a culpable driving where the victim's family want to support the young man who killed their son when he's released from prison. That came out of a restorative justice process. You wouldn't get that out of a normal justice process, which is highly adversarial. So that's how it works. It doesn't mean you don't go to jail, but it does mean that sentences are less, because it's actually much more worthwhile and much more remediative for defendants than simply warehousing them in prison.
Katrina, this has been implemented in the ACT. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, I can. So I think... thank you for that explanation of what restorative justice is. I think that it does definitely have potential to play an important part in perhaps the way that the criminal justice system alternatively responds to sexual violence. I think it's important to note that it is preferable to some victim survivors of sexual offences. It will not be preferable to all. In fact, it might present particular difficulties for many victims, victim survivors of sexual offences. But certainly it's an important part of the puzzle that I think is worthy of further consideration. Only I would say with the caveat that we need to be very careful about ensuring the right support systems are in place and that we're not risking people feeling compelled to engage in the restorative justice process as opposed to the criminal justice system. So it's really important that we have those supports in place. But certainly since November of 2018, the ACT has included family violence and sexual offence matters as part of their restorative justice unit, which has been going for some years longer than that. And as I understand it, a number of cases have been referred to the restorative justice in the ACT. I'm not intimately familiar with them. I don't work in that unit. But my understanding is that one matter has resolved through the process of restorative justice. And just as Greg has said, this can be a very... restorative process for some victim survivors of sexual offences, and I take it that that has been the experience of those for whom the process has been beneficial in the ACT. There is a process of making sure that there are relevant approvals, and as Greg said, the victim survivor has to consent. It has to be something that is appropriate for sexual offence matters, and that the restorative justice unit and the sort of qualified people who run that program can see that there is something that can be done for restorative justice processes, like a conferencing, whether an apology is going to be appropriate, a letter, some kind of restorative action, and whether it will be appropriate in that case. So as I say, it's been in there since November 2018, so that's over a year now, and there's been 8 referrals and one process that's finalised through restorative justice. I can't speak to the reason for the low number of referrals. I don't know, there might be quite a number of reasons.
Rena, what do you think that this would potentially be another option for survivors that might make it easier rather than going down that criminal adversarial system?
Yeah, I do. And I think it's a valuable option to have. I think as Katrina said, the benefit is giving survivors options. So I think in the past it was, well, go through this criminal justice system and the adversarial system, which might not lead to anything and will take, you know, 4 years or nothing. Or you just kind of cope with it and just try to deal with it yourself. And instead what we're seeing now is the importance of giving survivors options, whether it is going through a restorative justice process, whether we do a lot of work at Moores with universities and where abuse happens between students. It's not about, you know, wanting to go through a criminal case. It's about, I don't want to see this person in my class. I don't want this person to be living in my residence. There are a lot of different ways that we can support survivors that isn't, you know, the hard criminal justice system or doing nothing. It could even be sort of a restorative justice process that can be mediated within the community that they're in. So facilitating an apology, facilitating that discussion. And that might be what the survivor's looking for, and that might be enough for them in terms of putting it behind them and moving on. So I think it's a valuable option to have. There's obviously the need for that discussion and the consent and making sure that it's what the survivor wants and that it would be, you know, of assistance to the perpetrator as well in terms of understanding their behaviour and the impact of their behaviour. So there's definitely benefits to it, and I think it's a very valuable option.
Because it can be a barrier as well if it's someone's husband and they are a breadwinner who, you know, the survivor relies on for their children's education and funding and whatnot. So there are other barriers as well to think about.
Yeah, and I think that I've said this before, I think that sexual violence is by its nature defined by a violation of autonomy, and the fact that we offer so few options for response and restoration for survivors of sexual violence is a sort of continuation of that abrogation of autonomy. And so I believe that it is worth us investigating, perhaps providing a suite of options for sexual violence survivors so that they have some more autonomy about how they can respond to their experience. And as my colleague at the Swinburne Law School, Dr. Rachel Bergen, who I can see in the front row, has said many times, it's so much about the experience of survivors and not necessarily the outcome, which is where Greg's comments about perhaps lower sentences is relevant. Perhaps if there was a particular survivor who felt they were less invested in the sentencing outcome but were willing to go through a process where perhaps it was a lower standard of proof, and a corollary of that was a much different penalty scheme, maybe that's an option that we could provide. Perhaps an inquisitorial system instead of an adversarial system. Restorative justice might be one option. Having a victim's advocate if we're retaining the adversarial system is another option. So I think it is really important that we recognise that to give some of that autonomy back to victim survivors, we need to do a lot more than just focus on the criminal justice system, which is not to say that we shouldn't try and perfect it and improve upon it, but to do so at the expense of all other options, I think, would be a fool's errand.
Just moving on to consent. In the US, there have been apps created where people can swipe to consent to having sex before having sex, and Harvey Weinstein's lawyer, Donna Rotunno, recently advise that all people should sign a contract before having sex to stop for any complications later down the track. I mean, it seems absurd and could potentially be dangerous if someone signs a contract and halfway through they decide they don't want to anymore.
Or if they sign it under pressure.
Exactly, yeah. Yep. And apart from being socially awkward, is there any merit in this?
I think it's a common comment that's rolled out whenever we're discussing sexual assault law reform. It was rolled out, for example, in 2007 when New South Wales introduced the test of reasonableness into the honest mistaken belief in consent reform. As I said, that was in 2007. It was a comment that was rolled out then. It's routinely rolled out as a... I see it as a bit of an attempt to kind of derail the conversation and say, well, what are you asking us to kind of go this absurd step? When really, no, it's not about that. It's about... sort of considered measures for potentially changing the law around this area, but it's not about having to go to that stage. And as you've identified, there are inherent problems with that idea anyway. As you said, in terms of if you withdraw consent partway through, it's not really sort of the way that we work socially. And as I said, if it's there's some sort of pressure or coercion to sign, then that it's really a moot point.
Rena, you work with schools educating people about consent. Is this a question that comes up in your education classes?
Yeah, I was actually going to say you laugh, but it's probably one of the most common questions I get asked by young people, which is, oh, this is just too hard. Can you give me a pro forma contract and I'll just get them to sign it? And that to me just shows that there is a lack of understanding about what consent is. The idea that you could sign a contract and somehow that's consent just demonstrates that there's not an understanding of the fact that it is a conversation. I know that Victoria sort of emphasises a lot in our legislation, but it's about a communicative model. And I think we're moving away a lot from what used to be no means no. And, you know, unless you had a no, that somehow meant you had a yes, to a very enthusiastic model of yes means yes. And unless you have that enthusiastic yes, and unless you're talking to the person that you're with about what you're going to do and whether or not you're both on board, then you're just not going to have consent. And so it's about having that conversation with young people instead of... And I think breaking it down as well, I think the idea of consent is often talked about in a legal sense, and we don't talk about sex in the broader sense of what it is in terms of, you know, it's meant to be an exciting thing, it's a pleasurable thing, it's about desire and intimacy and love and all of those things that come with sex. And when you have the conversation about consent in that broader aspect, they start to understand that it's not just a legal checkbox that they've got to tick off before they can then do whatever they want. It is the broader aspect of that relationship and that respect that you have with another person. And so it is a common question that we get asked, but hopefully by the time that you then have a conversation with them, they understand it a bit more. I always say, if you think talking about sex is awkward, try to get someone to sign a contract about sex and explaining to that to them when you're 15 years old and you don't even know what a contract is. But somehow that's easier, apparently.
Greg, I don't want to get too legal on this, but consent laws are being constantly updated across the country, and they're obviously different in every state and territory. I know that you've voiced concerns about continuously changing consent laws. Do you think that there should be consent laws that are equivalent across the country, or what do you think is the best way
forward? Well, I mean, why would you have 8 consent laws when you could have one? I mean, you know, the absurdity of the Federation, of course, is that criminal law, so much of criminal law, unlike Canada, for example, is at the state and territory level. And it means you can get different definitions in each jurisdiction, which doesn't make sense. There ought to be a national criminal law in respect of the matter. Then you have certainty in each jurisdiction because you're an Australian, you're not a Tasmanian or a New South Welshman or, you know, in this day and age. I do think it's important, though, that there's clarity in the law because people, you know, the law is required to be certain so that people understand the law. I mean, understand what is the definition of rape, what is the definition of assault, what is the definition of consent. It is important that it be consistent. It's a difficult question, consent. It's a difficult question because there are varying philosophical views. As someone who teaches jurisprudence, there are varying philosophical views about consent. I mean, if you are a person who subscribes to liberalism, and I mean that, I don't mean the political party, I mean the true philosophy, you may have a different view than if you are a person who, for example, is associated with one of the strands of feminist jurisprudence or critical race theory. There are a range of... This is a complex word. I mean, the postmodernists get some things right, and deconstruction of this word is extraordinarily difficult. And so it's a continuing conversation, and, of course, the issue of consent evolves as we evolve, but there, at the end of the day, there needs to be a national definition. It ought not depend on where you live in this country.
Katrina, you did a Churchill Fellowship in looking at consent education across the Netherlands, Germany, Ireland, UK. What do you think our consent literacy is like in Australia? And how do you think, we don't have much time left, but how do you think our understanding of consent as a nation impacts the courts?
In several ways, and one, as I mentioned earlier, is the way that potentially juries understand it and how that affects the decisions that juries make, also judges, if the judge is the tribunal of fact, but also the way that obviously the community, different aspects of the community, the victim survivor, the accused. I think, Greg, you talked about certainty, and I think that the fact that there are, that many people within the community feel that consent and sexual offence laws do not represent their experience or understanding of what consent should be is something that we should really consider if we are thinking about taking a nationally consistent approach. And I agree, we should have a nationally consistent approach if the legislation is good. So I would put that caveat on it. But, I think that it's really important that we focus on actually building understanding and capacity within the community around what consent is and what respectful relationships are, and skills building in terms of having those conversations so that people don't feel that maybe they need a contract or an app to sort of understand whether someone's consenting. Being able to actually... instill those values and those attitudes and behaviours in young people is really the only one of the only proven measures for the prevention of sexual violence that we know of. And so I think that's extremely important, not just for the implications on the criminal justice system, but for the implications for everybody's sexual well-being. It's not just about preventing sort of violence, it's also about ensuring sexual well-being for everybody. So I think it's really important for a number of reasons.
Rena, do you think that current education or consent literacy in Australia is lacking, and how can we improve it? Like, how early should we be learning about consent?
Yeah, good question. So Victoria, I think we're lucky to be one of the most progressive states in this space. So we do have respectful relationships curriculum that gets rolled out from prep to year 12. Again, though, it's probably one of those policy measures that was looked better on paper than it does in practice, because schools are sort of delivered this, you know, stacks of paper that they're supposed to teach students, and the teachers just don't have the time to do it. So I definitely think it can be improved. We need to understand as well that the way that young people talk and look about consent is consistently changing. And so Empowered Together, the organisation I volunteer with, focuses more on a facilitation model rather than a lecture model, because if you end up thinking that you know what young people need to know, you're missing the mark. And an example would be when we go to talk to young people and we ask them what consent looks like for them, they're not writing yes and, you know, do you want to have sex? It's emojis, you know, it's eggplant emojis and it's spraying water emojis, and that's how they talk about consent. And so if we went in there and we talked to them with our language, just go way over their head, and they think we're so lame, which they already do, but even more so. And so we need to listen. If consent education, it's really important that you learn almost as much as you teach. We've got to learn from young people about what they want to know and the language that they're using, and then mold that to the principles that we want them to take away and understand how it plays out and, you know, in their day and age now.
Katrina, just in some of the research that you did overseas, what are some of the things that we could potentially implement in Australia?
So many things. But I think that it is really important to start quite young. Mm-hmm. It's extreme. The places that I visited, they started as young as 3 and 4. Now, that isn't an age and developmentally appropriate way in terms of how they're talking about consent and relating to one another and relationships and families and those sorts of things. So starting young is very important. Equipping schools and teachers effectively, mm-hmm. so they're not just being given a whole lot of curriculum and said, you know, good luck and hope it goes well. They're actually being trained and given the skills and the leadership from school support, from school administration rather, they're given the support from those sides of the education system to actually deliver and roll that out. As well as engaging parents, it's very important to bring the home into this as well. It's not to silo responsibility with the school, but to create an integrated system that brings in parents and gives the parents literacy around these issues as well, and assurance about the kinds of questions that are normal for a 3-year-old to ask. And, you know, it's normal for a 4-year-old to sort of ask questions about penis and vagina and those sorts of things. These aren't things to be troubled by, for example. So there are quite a number of things we need to do. I think engaging public support, so, and by that I mean government support, public community support for this as a preventative measure, and saying this is a matter of well-being of our young people. This is something we all have a stake in, and therefore we need to actually act in a comprehensive and consistent way, and ensuring that those education things don't fall to the bottom of the timetable and they aren't left off because they're seen as less important, but they're given the priority that they deserve. And that can't just be up to individual teachers and schools. It needs to be a really integrated approach. And so I saw examples where it was legislated, for example, that it was mandatory for students to undertake a certain level of relationships and sex education. And I think the last thing would be to evaluate it, to make sure that it's working and that you have some accountability in terms of that being rolled out. But I think taking a strategic approach is probably the takeaway that I had from my research, was that you can't just kind of do this piecemeal. It needs to be a high-level strategic policy approach.
Great. I think that's all we have time for. Thank you so much to our wonderful panel.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.